I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we'll discuss the greatest spectacle in racing. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the Indianapolis 500. Through 10 decades, the month of May has meant motorsports in central Indiana. We will talk about a century of triumph and tragedy and winners and losers at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We'll discuss the history of the race with 1998 500 winner Eddie Cheever Jr., veteran race announcer Bob Jenkins, and Mark Dill, Vice President of Marketing and Communications for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And, of course, you. You can join the conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending comments or questions via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Please do join this discussion about one of the biggest events in Indiana. First, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about the greatest spectacle in racing, the Indianapolis 500, which is celebrating the 100th anniversary of the first running of the 500 this month. We're fortunate to have as our guests Bob Jenkins, who is a veteran race announcer. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Good to have you here. Eddie Cheever, Jr., driver and owner, winner of the 1998 500. Eddie, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Glad to have you here. And Mark Dill, who is the Vice President of Marketing and Communications for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Mark, good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, normally I would start with some sort of general background question, but we already have gotten a lot of emails about one subject in particular, so I figure we'll deal with that right out of the bat. That subject can be summed up pretty much in two words: Donald Trump. He's become kind of the live wire for this year's 500. Mark, I think this is probably in your wheelhouse. Can you talk a little bit about the decision to have the Donald drive this year's pace car, and whether there are any regrets or anything like that, given the news he's generated over the past few months?
Quite a bit of news. It certainly wasn't the situation that we anticipated when we did invite him. Inviting him was with good reasoning. I mean, he's a media giant. He gets tons of attention. I think at this juncture, it's safe to say some of the attention that we've gotten, we could have done without. But it was hard to predict all that. But at this juncture, we're really in a situation where we're monitoring it because we are aware. I know personally, and I think I can speak for everybody at the Speedway, that it pains us a great deal when we hear from our fans and that we hear that they're not happy. They're our customers. They're the people we try to put first. And so we don't like to hear that feedback, and we respect it, and we try to listen to them. I think the best I can say at this moment is that we're monitoring the situation.
Is there a contingency plan in place? I mean, I would assume there are all sorts of things when you invite somebody to drive a pace car, even aside from sort of the political dynamics of this one. You know, people do have accidents. They get ill. They get sick. You almost always have to have a plan B. Is there a plan B in this case?
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. There's a plan B for everything. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way when you approach an event of this magnitude with so many moving parts, it's almost perpetually a fluid environment. But certainly we have to have a backup plan for this and any other aspect. So, yeah, we're in good shape there.
What is plan B? Can you share that?
I don't know that I want to go there. I think there's it wouldn't stretch the imagination too far to think about a list of very qualified people, maybe one sitting right beside me, that could hop in the mix.
Bob, and that is, you know how to drive that pace car.
I was referring to Bob.
Yeah, right.
So there would be no problem in filling that particular seat, but at this juncture, we're just monitoring the situation.
What do you look for? And then this will be my sort of last question, unless the audience starts driving us back in this area. When you're deciding on who should drive the pace car, what are the criteria that are in place? What's the process for determining that who that person will be?
Well, and the way the sport has evolved and the obvious need in all sports to attract attention, reach beyond your markets, we've got a terrific core fan base. And our market studies actually show we've got this 73% net promoter score, which basically says that more than 7 out of 10 people that walk out of the speedway after the race go and shout about it and tell everybody what a great event it was and that they should come too. So our core fans are great advocates for us. And what we also want to try to do is reach new audiences. And with people like Donald or some of the other, you can think of Morgan Freeman, you can think of Colin Powell, some of the other pace car drivers in recent memory, they have an outreach to a much larger group of people beyond the scope of our core fans. And so we're always looking for how can we expand our markets? And so those are decisions. Obviously, the person has to have the desire to do it, the physical ability to do it, and be willing to spend the time, because it's no joke going around the speedway at 120 miles an hour in a pace car. And it's something that people need to take seriously and be willing to go through the training necessary to get the job done.
And what I misspoke. I have one more question on this subject. So that's a nicer term than saying I lied. But I misspoke. What statement were you trying to make, or was the Speedway trying to make, by having Donald Trump this year? I mean,
well, what
presuming before all of the other stuff came along.
Trump is a huge brand. It's beyond the man himself. But you can look at, the Celebrity Apprentice, for example, has over 3 million viewers weekly. Very popular show. And look around. He's an icon in the media. And so, obviously, our ability then to extend our messages and reach an audience that is far larger than our core base, and whether it's actually purchasing tickets for the speedway, for the race, or tuning in to the race, it gives us the opportunity to reach out to people far beyond the scope of who we would normally reach. And I guess a message to our core fans, I want them to really consider that, because we've been doing a lot of work with our fans. I developed a fan council after I came to the speedway about a year ago, and very listening to them very intently. And I think one of the messages that I've carried forward to them, that when you get a chance to sit down and talk to them, they realize that what we are trying to do is preserve and advance and grow the sport. And so when you explain it to them in those terms, and unfortunately I can't get around to every single person individually, but when I have a chance to sit down and explain it to them in those terms, I get a lot of nodding heads and say, okay, we get it. You're trying to do the best for the business. And at the same time, there's so much good stuff this month, and this is what I really want to be talking about. But if you look at all the great things that are happening this month, that the previous months of May have really almost skeletal by comparison. Mm-hmm. You look at, for example, inviting the 268 living participants at the in the Indianapolis 500 back for a world's largest autograph session. All the vintage cars are going to be out there. It's just an incredible assembly throughout the month, and this is the thing that I think our core fans really love. I think you hear a very vocal, a lot of vocal commentary, but we're getting a lot of enthusiasm. I can't wait, kind of comments. So there's a lot of good stuff in there for people that really love the 500, love the Speedway.
Is that one of the regrets in that it has sort of taken you off message? This May is supposed to be about celebrating this century-long legacy, really. And instead you're talking about a lot of things that have
absolutely
nothing to do with racing.
Well, I mean, just to the standpoint that what I'd love to be doing is talking to you about, well, this Sunday we're going to have Emerging Tech Day, and that's going to be a really neat event. It's about looking forward, not just reviewing our history. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a lot of electric vehicles out there. Chevrolet's going to be out there doing ride and drives. Anybody with an electric car, register on our site, and you can come out and take a lap around the speedway. We're going to have three collegiate competitions, again, reaching out to a younger demographic. There's going to be probably 35 to 40 universities competing. Some are already out there right now, called the American Solar Challenge. They are out there in turn four in what we call our shifter cart course, and they're running around right now while we speak. And those are really interesting cars. They're all crafted by the universities, and they're charged by solar panels. So it's going to be an educational day, but that's just an example. That's just this Saturday, and that's before we even get into the official beginning of IndyCar practice.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are the kinds of things I'm eager to talk about, absolutely.
Well, we can shift subjects now, and I would like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a question or comment via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Eddie Cheever, could you talk a little bit, given that this is the 100th anniversary, and obviously you've been pretty intimately involved with the 500, what is the enduring allure of the Indianapolis 500? There are a lot of races out there. What has made this one special and made it special for so long?
We are a very young country when you compare our history to Europe and Asia. And there are very few events in America that have been around that long. And the Indianapolis 500 is not an event that you have to explain to somebody. It's renowned all over the world. And I think the fact that it is such a jewel in the worldwide racing environment just makes for a very compelling story. I think 100 years in Europe really isn't that big of a deal, but 100 years in America really is, and it's tied so closely to cars that I think it's just wonderful. It has such a compelling story behind it, and it is. Every year, you know, there's going to be a winner, and every year there's going to be a rookie of the year. And the same story keeps building on itself, but every year it's a different set of players. And when you go back into the history of the 500, there's just so many exciting stories, so many things. I'm proud that my family is a part of that. I like the fact that my family has participated in the race, and that when I'm long gone, there will be this cup with my family name on it. I'm sure all the other drivers feel the same way, but I have never tied my affection to the 500 because of the fact that I won. I tied it more to the fact that I got to compete, that I was part of this play, this Indiana play that happens every year, and I think it's just great. I would like to go back just for one short second to what you were saying about Trump. I never viewed the Indianapolis 500 as a political statement, so I think it's great. Mm-hmm. Whether you agree or disagree, they're talking about it. People are talking about the 500. They're talking about Trump. What did Caesar say once? Talk about me, ill or good. Just make sure you're talking about me. So in this
or
case,
spell the name right,
or something. Yeah. I think it's a great choice. Whether you agree with it politically or what he's saying or you don't, I don't think anything he said is overly offensive in the political spectrum of what happens.
Yeah, driving the pace car does not constitute an endorsement of anybody's political.
He's not exactly saying that the unions should not have collective bargaining, or that that's not what this is about. This is a joyous weekend where many Americans will sit down and watch the 100th Indianapolis 500.
Yeah, it is interesting when you talk about this. Everybody talks about the history and really the lifestyle and the ins and outs. I mean, I think the only parallel I can think of in the sports world, it's almost like the motorsports equivalent of baseball or whatever. There are similar sort of interests in the legacies and all of that. To understand the game, you have to understand the history as well. Is that part of the allure, Bob Jenkins, do you think?
Yeah, I suppose so. I'm kind of straddling the fence on this issue, really. I realize that Trump was probably invited to be the pace car driver before the recent political rumblings occurred. On the other hand, he will join, if he does drive the pace car, a long list of notable people who will be remembered down through the years. And, you know, I really don't have a problem with it. I remember Chuck Yeager when he came here to drive the pace car. There have been so many great drivers, former drivers of the 500, who have driven the pace car. But for some reason, I remember Chuck Yeager as the most famous among that group, someone who had achieved so many things in space and in the air, was able to drive the car around the track and pace the field. It's quite an honor to drive the pace car for the 500, one that I'm not so sure that I would want.
We are talking about the history of the Indianapolis 500 as it marks its 100th anniversary. Here on No Limits, we are talking with Bob Jenkins, Eddie Cheever Jr., and Mark Dill. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking about the 100th anniversary of the first running of the Indianapolis 500. We're fortunate to have as our guests Bob Jenkins, veteran race announcer, Eddie Cheever Jr., the 1998 winner of the 500, and Mark Dill, who is the vice president of marketing and communications for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Well, we've talked a little bit about, you know, the elephant in the room with the Donald Trump thing. But, Mark, you've made the point that there's a lot else that's going on with the 500 this time around. And I guess with Bob and Eddie as veteran participants in the process, I'd like to talk a little bit about really what those events are. What are the things, Eddie, that you are most excited about this month? And what keeps bringing people back to the 500?
There's too many. I really wouldn't. I mean, one that
we'll
I really
start
like.
With your favorite then.
All the pretty girls come out because the train's finally here. It's just you have to come to the 500 to actually understand it. You cannot do it just by reading, or even I don't believe you can get it with the television. It's just it's an event. It's such a heritage that is so well rooted in this community that the whole city, it's like it comes out from the winter. Finally, the winter is over and we start the actual summer or spring, whatever you want, with the Indy 500. There's always a sound of the cars you can see. Every year I've come here, I will start talking to either an elder person that has been watching it for 40 years and they'll have stories to share, or I'll see a kid for the first time. There's just so much emotion tied around the Indy 500, and you can tell that all of Indianapolis is incredibly proud of it, and there will be, at the end of the month, a new Indianapolis 500 champion. Mm-hmm. And there, you have to tie it. What hasn't happened in the past 10 years is that there haven't been enough compelling reasons for drivers maybe to be tied to a story or something. There hasn't been in the past. You can't reinvent an AJ Foyt. It's not possible. You have to build them step by step. So maybe that's the evolution that the 500 is.
Or they emerge once in a generation, or once in a half century, or whatever. Bob Jenkins, how long have you been coming to the 500, working it, and all of that?
I first came to the Speedway in 1957 to watch time trials. It was a rainy Saturday, and my dad brought me. We sat in the car in the third turn and watched those cars go by. My first 500-mile race was in 1960. I missed 61 and 65, but have been to every race since then.
So pretty much a 50-year string.
Yeah, quite a roll. There are so many things that are going on during the month of May this year that occur every year, but there are also some very special events that will be going on. But when you come right down to it, it is getting up on race morning and saying to yourself, it's race day in Indianapolis. And it is going to the Speedway. It is seeing the people gather for the race. It is hearing the traditional things that we hear back home again in Indiana, the release of the balloons, the command to start engines, the 33 cars lining up. I'm getting goosebumps, you might notice.
Yeah, it's the ritual.
It's the ritual. It's the thing. It is the incredible. You will never find it anywhere else, either in sports or in any other area, I believe. It is seeing the cars line up. It is seeing them come down for the green flag, and the race is on, and so many things can happen on the first lap. So many things can happen in the middle of the race, and so many things can happen on the last lap of the race. It's just the Indianapolis 500, and nothing will ever, ever come close to what it is.
What is the thing that is the most exciting, that you're most excited about this time around seeing? Is it still just the race itself,
or
are there other...
The opening ceremonies, the 20 minutes before the start of the race, are very emotional for me. The playing of taps always brings tears to my eyes. I think back about when I first came, my dad bringing me, coming with my family. When we first came in 1960, we rode the train to the Speedway. And my dad and I sat in the on the main straightaway in Grandstand C. And I think about those times. And I just think about everything that I do, everything that I have, and thank God that I am able to witness the 500 and having a part in it, and I've had many roles, is just a very, very special thing. But yes, it is the race itself. It is the 500-mile race from early morning until the end of the day.
And Eddie Cheever, if I could sort of redirect, as I think probably the only person in this room who's had the experience of being a driver in the race, is it special, different from all of the other races that you would compete in, and what makes it different for the drivers? I mean, what is it, that history, or you know, the knowledge that you're going to be competing against the best?
I came to the 500 via a different route. I was born in Arizona, but I lived in Italy most of my life, and I started racing road racing, and I went on to have a 10-year career in Formula One and in sports car racing, where I raced at Monte Carlo with Renault, and I raced at Jaguar at the 24 Hours of Le Mans. So I came from a different direction than most American or Brazilian drivers that you have here now. For me, wanting to participate in the 500 was because my father kept telling me as a child all these stories about Foyt and Rutherford and how dangerous it was and the speed. And we were an American family living in Italy, and we always remained an American family. So my attraction to it was the history of it. I love the fact that Clark raced here. I love the fact that Stewart raced here. I love the fact that Alan Jones, who I had great admiration from in Formula One, did three laps and said, you know, you're all crazy. I'm not going to do this. And this is somebody who I thought was one of the bravest race car drivers I have ever seen. And I don't think it's right to say, I hate it when a series says we have the best drivers. Everything in racing now is so, there's so many different segments and different talents that you have to have. These are the best open wheel, oval race car drivers in the world. Mm-hmm. That I am comfortable with. And whoever wins this race has had to avoid so many obstacles in the race, has had to prepare himself for the whole month, has had to work with the team, and you have to be on the best game you can have for that for that afternoon, that 3.5 hours. And it's almost impossible to do. It's not really, the speeds are so fast, it's just incredible. So there's so many things that can go wrong and do go wrong. So when somebody actually manages to win one, that's an accomplishment. But there are drivers out there racing now that have won three. Mm-hmm. And two, and there's Danica, and there's just so many different compelling stories. So I was attracted to it because I was an American, mm-hmm. racing all around the world, and I wanted to come home. And when I came home, I wanted to win the Indianapolis 500. But it was something that I wanted as an American race car driver. I'm sure if you'd ask Kanaan, he would have a different reason. His reason might be the fact that Fittipaldi won it. Mm-hmm. And it is, that's a lot of people. Have you ever sat in the Indy 500 and looked around? I mean, I remember the first race I was there. I looked around.
That's a good sized city all by itself.
City? Yeah. I lived in smaller countries.
Yeah.
I mean, it's enormous. And this mountain of people that stands up at the start of the race, and And when they say they start your engines, I mean, it's a different world. You cannot describe it. It would be impossible to build that again anywhere in the world. It's just so unique and so American, and it is so Indiana. I'm at a loss for words when somebody asks me. In fact, after I won it, I really liked the fact that I never had to explain to anybody what the Indianapolis 500 was. Everybody knows.
Yeah, and what you made a point, obviously, about earlier you mentioned A.J. Foyt and the folks mm-hmm. like that, and then also talked about kind of the fragmentation now in the racing world, the explosion of technology and all of that. Is it still possible to see A.J. Foyt's or Johnny Rutherford's or other great Indianapolis 500 legends emerge these days?
There are three drivers that have won it four times. Mears mm-hmm. did it all in Penske organization. Unser, mm-hmm. who did it with a variety of teams. And then you have Foyt, who did, I think, one of his victories was driving for a different team and three were driving for himself. I think what I don't like about IndyCars right now is that you have created a scenario where there really are two monopolies now, one which is Penske, the other one which is Ganassi. And, you know, thank God for Ganassi that has finally managed to put a group together that can go neck to neck with Penske. But these two groups have such a dominance in the race that it's difficult for somebody to wiggle the way in. I would like to see changes where that board is wiped clean, and so opportunities like what happened with Penske and Alberti in the past and Unser's and Foyt to reoccur again. There's too much monopoly in racing and in IndyCar racing. But
sort of changes would you like to see?
I think the emphasis needs to be put. I mean, everybody always says that the equipment is the same, but I forget what the name of the book. I think it was called Animal Farm, where all the animals were equal.
Yes, Orwell. But some are more equal than others.
Yes, but some are more equal than others. Well, yeah. I think you've created a scenario where, and I commend Penske and Ganassi's ability to raise funds and organize themselves the way they've done, but they have managed to get technical advantages where they're like a mile an hour quicker at Indy. There's nothing you can do about that. So the organizing body has to find ways to mitigate those advantages that large teams can have and open the door so that like a Tony Stewart can come in. Tony Stewart was with the IRL when it started and won the championship one year. Now it's almost impossible to see that happen unless you are in one of those two teams. But I think they made a lot of changes in the past, and you will see them. So there's a lot of lessons they could learn. This is a bad word in IndyCar racing. There's a lot of lessons that they could learn from NASCAR.
Well, that's open to can of worms. And is that, Bob Jenkins, been one of the issues that sort of faced the IndyCar world?
Yes.
Is the explosion of NASCAR.
Well, although I think NASCAR's popularity is waning greatly. You'll see lots of empty seats at their racetracks, whereas in the past you had to go on a waiting list to get a ticket. Their television ratings are steady or declining somewhat. I think what Eddie is talking about is going to be changed beginning next year because we will have various engine manufacturers enter the game. And obviously, one of the engines is going to be a little better than the others. And if a Penske or Ganassi chooses the wrong engine, so to speak, he's going to be at a disadvantage. The same will apparently occur in 2013 with the aero packages. They had hoped, of course, to go to the new aero packages beginning next year, but apparently the car owners don't want that, and so it might be delayed until 2013. And that will also, I think, create a situation in which one of them will hit on the right combination and the other, however many more, will not. And that could very well be the equalizer for some of the smaller teams that we are seeing now do as well, if not better, than the Penske's, Ganassi's, Andretti's, and so forth.
We are talking about the Indianapolis 500 and its first 100 years of history. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. John, I understand you're calling from Zionsville. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks.
But I would, unfortunately, like to go back to the elephant in the room.
Okay. Well, you clearly were listening closely. You're using my metaphor.
Well, I'll use another one. The 500 proudly announces itself as the greatest spectacle in racing. Well, unfortunately, there are two kinds of meanings to the word spectacle. And by choosing Donald Trump, you've chosen somebody who, regardless of his presidential ambitions, his whole career has been that of being a spectacle. And he will now put himself in front of, sadly. And whatever happens with his presidential ambitions, he'll just double down. And it's an insult to Chuck Yeager or any of the other prior drivers, however else they were chosen, to compare them to the Donald. And I'll hang up by just suggesting this. The Indy 500 as an organization finds itself in a place that businesses often find themselves in. Oh my gosh, we've made a bad decision. Now, you can minimize it, you can pretend the elephant's not in the room, just like a lot of businesses do often, or you can have the courage early in the month to sacrifice the Donald and get somebody who's much more in the tradition and do the organizationally courageous thing, and I know that it'll be a lot better for all concerned. Now, having said all that, I'm a guy who remembers Eddie Sachs along with Eddie Cheever in Europe and in the United States, as well as Will Power, so perhaps I'm the wrong demographics for the one gentleman there. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call. Well, in terms of the Donald Trump thing, and we have talked about this at some length, I guess, Mark Dill, I would ask, have you done any sort of polling or survey work just to see where your fan base is on this thing? And if you have, what are the results shown?
Well, we certainly have gotten a lot of feedback through the media. Yesterday I did ask for a survey to be conducted. So I should have the results today, tomorrow. So there's not a whole lot to add other than that. I mean, I think what we're getting back through the media, obviously we're getting fan feedback. We're aware of the Facebook site. So there's a lot of information coming at us, and obviously it's not what we'd like to see, and it's not what we anticipated when we first made the arrangement with Donald.
Has there been, although, as Eddie Cheever said earlier in the program, there are a lot of people talking about the 500 now. I mean, has there been any upside, basically, to this controversy in that, you know, at least professionally, politicians use the term earned media, and you have picked up a fair amount of earned media out of this, maybe not exactly on the message you wanted it
right.
to be on, but people are talking about the 500.
Right, and I respect everyone's opinion. I truly do. And as I said, we're monitoring the situation. But as I said at the beginning, we'd much rather be talking about our events. Mm-hmm. I'd like to make points like throughout the month, for the first time ever, kids 12 and under are free. Mm-hmm. General admission. We've got two great free days. We've dedicated a day to A.J. Foyt. That'll be the day before the 500. And that's when we're going to have what we call our world's largest autograph session. That's going to be pretty neat. We're going to have a bunch of vintage sprint and midget cars out there. Several of them were driven by AJ, others by Mario, the Unsers, you know, how they came up in the sport in the old school way. We're going to have a giant memorabilia show. That's all going to be free the day before the Indy 500. So, and then on pole and bump day, we're going to have 250-plus vintage pace cars. It's going to be the largest review of vintage pace cars that's ever been assembled before. I think people are going to appreciate that. Plus, qualifying is just a darn entertaining show. If somebody wasn't there last year and they're thinking about it, it's like, well, it's definitely worth the price of admission. It's only $15. Like I say, 12 and under free. You're not going to find entertainment value more reasonable than that. And with the number of drivers that are entered this year, this is the largest entry list for a good many years. We're going to have a really serious bump day. There's going to be some painful rejections here on that Sunday, the 22nd. And I think our fans are going to enjoy that.
We are talking about the history of the Indianapolis 500 with our guests, Bob Jenkins, Eddie Cheever Jr., and Mark Dill. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about the Indianapolis 500 and are fortunate to have as our guests veteran race announcer Bob Jenkins, Eddie Cheever Jr., who won the 1998 Indianapolis 500, and Mark Dill, who is vice president of marketing and communications at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Eddie, you wanted to pick up on a point that that Mark Dill made just before we went to the break.
Yes. You had asked me a question earlier, what I would like to see change in IndyCars to open up the field to more opportunity. And I think, Mike, really, you really hit it on the head when you talked about one of the things that are going to happen during the month of May is all the old school cars coming back. That is the river that feeds the Indianapolis 500. And we have gone away from that dramatically. Dramatically. I mean, that's what I loved about IndyCars when it actually created the IRL and that great earthquake happened where one group at one went the other way, is that you had, I raced against and had to deal with a guy called Tony Stewart. Mm-hmm. And this guy came out of nowhere. I mean, I remember seeing him once at a midget car race where he looked like he'd been wrestling in mud. He was covered in grease and dirt, and I watched him drive. And I remember thinking, oh, man, that kid's good. And all of a sudden, here he pops into Menard's team where I was racing, and this guy was unbelievably fast and incredibly talented and went on to do what he has done in NASCAR. Those people don't go to IndyCars anymore. They don't go there. It's not someplace they go. They go to NASCAR because it offers, they believe, a better opportunity. You have to go back to the days and maybe be a little bit more humble technically than IndyCars have been now and try to open those floodgates up and allow drivers like Tony Stewart and drivers that don't really have great financial means to participate and find a way to find a car to drive in the Indy 500. But you have to also manage the equipment so that you cannot have one group that is light years ahead of the rest of the field, because that isn't real. It isn't real. It becomes a technical exercise instead of a driver's exercise. And thank you for bringing that up. I'm embarrassed that I didn't add that to your previous question.
No, that's a nice addition, Eddie. And I'd also like to say that in that same vein, what we know about our fans is they love history. They really, really love the history of this event. And so even though maybe we haven't firmly established the connection back to the old school path up the ladder, there are going to be so many vintage cars out there. I would say we're going to have close to 1,000 between the race cars, classic cars. It's going to be an amazing display. I know you're ready to punch a button here and get somebody on the line, but John, I want to add, for the celebration of automobiles, for example, it's going to be on opening day. This is a big classic car show. Again, another value point. $10 to get into the opening day. If you went to Pebble Beach and saw a lot of the same cars, you're going to be paying $175. I just want people to understand. We have one car that was formerly owned by Winston Churchill. We've got another one that was a Herman Garrig staff car that was captured by the 102nd Airborne in the United States. Lots of really interesting stuff, and those are the stories that I'm excited to talk about.
Taylor, welcome to the program. Taylor, how are you?
Oh, hey, how you guys doing?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us.
Well, okay, got the rain's gone. No wonder everyone's doing well. You guys mentioned how NASCAR is waning in popularity and they're losing viewers. Well, on the other end of the spectrum, you have motorcycle racing gaining a lot of ground, specifically Superbike and especially the FIM MotoGP series. And I was wondering if there's any lessons you could take that the IRL could take from that series, both from a technological and a marketing aspect.
Thank you for the question. We'll see if we can get an answer for you. Bob Jenkins.
I have no idea. I'm not familiar with that group, what their marketing plans are, whatever. Of course, we have a big motorcycle race at the Speedway every year, but I don't know.
Well, was that is the question sort of in the spirit of opening up innovation, Eddie Cheever, that you were talking about just a moment ago?
Somewhat. I mean, there are many different ways of solving this problem, and I think, I mean, what I sense here is a kind of a feeling that Bob had that NASCAR is going losing viewership. Let's put everything in perspective. American oval racing is healthy in the United States, and the large gorilla in this, the one that has been very successful, has been NASCAR, and IndyCars has been trending the wrong way for some time now, probably 10 or 15 years. To focus on what NASCAR is doing, I think, is really irrelevant at this point, because, like Mike, you said before, there is a very large group of people that follow open wheel racing and look at the success that you have here at the 500 every year. I mean, there's not many empty seats. Mm-hmm. So what IndyCar needs to focus is understanding what the public wants to see, because you cannot compare NASCAR with IndyCar right now. They're just in different realms. They live in different spaces. I think there's a big opportunity with these changes that are happening if it is managed properly and you access all of those dirt car drivers and sprint car drivers all over the United States, and not just opening up the series for foreign drivers that are looking for some place to bring their budgets. Mm-hmm. You have a good possibility of recreating the aura that created the Foyts and the Unsers. I mean, look at one family. We talked about Foyt. We didn't talk about the Unsers. One family won nine Indianapolis 500s. And by the way, one of them won four. Another one won three. And the youngest one won two. Now, tell me if that's not a compelling historical event. I think it's incredible.
Yeah,
there's so many of those stories, and for anybody to come and look, this is a race where if you make a big enough mistake, let's get down to the facts. You can kill yourself. Yeah. I mean, it's dangerous. I unfortunately have lived through many of those, and so there's many things that makes even driving at the 500 a very compelling story. And all these midget car racers and sprint car drivers, all these drivers need to feel that the door is open. The door is open for them in NASCAR racing. That's why they gravitate there. The door is not open in IndyCars. And that's what I think they need to focus on. Bob
is really getting to the sort of the revisit the Horatio Alger aspect of racing here and allowing people to rise up through it. Bob Jenkins.
I certainly wish that there were more drivers who came up through the ranks of sprint and midget racing, and I think that the IndyCar series is on the right track by making it clear that they do too. For instance, Brian Clausen, who was the overall champion of the United States Auto Club last year, will get a ride in the Firestone Indy Lite series. Hopefully will propel him into the IndyCar series itself. However, let me remind you that a few years ago when the IRL, as it was known then, was created, the door was open and several drivers from those ranks came to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to race in the 500. I'm talking about people like Joe Gosek, who was from the Northeast and drove modifieds. I'm talking about Steve Kinzer, who drove World of Outlaw sprint cars. And I'm talking about people like Jack Hewitt. What was the
reaction? Tony Stewart.
Yep.
And Tony Stewart.
But what was
and
the
reaction?
Yep. What was the reaction of the media, though, at that time? The cry and hue was, where are the good drivers? Where are the most professional drivers in the world? And that really bothered me.
I agree, but that's like the political environment in America. I think politics in America is one of the most, having lived in Europe, it is bloody, it is gruesome, it is embarrassing, but it's the way we are in this country. We like to have good open discussion, so a good open discussion is healthy. But the reality is when those drivers came in, the other series ceased to exist.
Right.
Honda and Toyota came over. They moved their argument from one series over to the IndyCars. Now, all of a sudden, if you did not have a Honda engine, you could not win a race.
Right.
So all of the work that had been done was thrown out the window. Then, guess what? Honda and Toyota decided to leave. And there was this big vacuum. And everybody's saying, what are we going to do now? So we are, and I say we because I do feel emotionally tied to IndyCars. I think the Indianapolis 500 is wonderful. But you need to find a constant goal and keep reaching for it? Why do you want to throw away 100 or 90 or 80 years of history? Your history lies in the era that produced the Foyts, the Rutherfords, the Unsers, all the Mario Andretti.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you want to go away from that? I don't know the technical reasons or the technical changes that you have to make that happen. But politically, you have to make sure that door is open. You cannot compete technically with Formula One. Mm-hmm. To assume that you're going to be a Formula One is ridiculous. That's like me saying, I'm going to buy a pair of tennis shoes, and I can run 100 meters, and I'm going to start getting ready for the next Olympics. You cannot compete with a Formula One team. The budget of a Formula One team right now is $400 million. So why do you want to try to emulate something that is so far out of your reach?
Yeah, the startup costs are a little high there.
Yeah, but it doesn't make sense. But you do have a core. Go out, and you keep talking to all the fans that you talk in the grandstands. Go talk to them, to the older generation, and they will tell you that the night before the race, they would go here to the state park, the state fair, and they would watch the race there. And if you were – there's just too much goodwill that you're not – there's too much goodwill that you're not fishing from.
We've got a caller, I think, who wants to speak to that theme. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
My comment has to do with Eddie Cheever was saying. I have memories. I'm 57 years old. I have memories of being in my backyard, listening to Tom Carnegie and others on the radio, you know, Howdy Bell, following them around the track. I've never gone to the race. I've never been in a position to be able to do so because I'm always preaching on Sunday mornings. And so to be able to go to the race now, that's impossible for me. However, I make sure that my sermon is really short so that I can get home and
Okay.
Good for you.
But the race has meant so much to the state of Indiana, and it's part of our identity. And the things that Mr. Cheever was talking about the values of the people involved, and that is so, it's ingrained in us. And I have very high regard for the marketing guy that you have with you there, and how he's trying really hard to make up for somebody's kind of bonehead.
Well, one hand giveth, the other taketh away.
Well, it's something like that.
Yeah.
I think I think he ought to get a big steak dinner from whoever made that decision, because it is the antithesis of what the race stands for, and has nothing whatsoever to do with the current political climate. It's just the antithesis of what. Well, the Holmans over the years, think about the difference they have made in our state, not just in Indianapolis, but all of the work that they have done. Rose Holman Institute of Technology, one of the finest engineering institutions in the country, probably the world. And
Dave, I'd like to...
You can tell I'm a preacher.
I can't. Well, and you're making good points, but I would like to give our guests a chance to respond to some of them. Thank you for the call. Take care.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and we have a similar comment, a tweet coming in that's also somewhat thoughtful, and I'm going to summarize it real, real quickly. It does somewhat come back to the Trump thing, but they say, and I imagine this is one of the things that creates some agony for all three of you, because what's come out of this program is clear that you all have a really deep love for this tradition and a reverence for it, is that the folks who are upset about Donald Trump say it's not that they're all that concerned about Donald Trump, it's that they're really invested in what they see as the traditions of the 500 as well. Is this in some ways like a family quarrel, Mark Dill?
I don't know that I'd characterize it by that, but it is a balancing act. And as I said, we have to be thinking about reaching out and obtaining new fans. We didn't talk about the Mattel Fearless at the 500 stunt at the Speedway the morning of the race. Well, clearly what we're doing is reaching out to younger people. Some of the young adults, they love that kind of sort of action extreme sports, as well as families with young kids that just love those little Hot Wheel racers. We've got a special ticket package where they're going to receive those cars. So, you know, we have to strike that balance.
What is the, do you think, is the single greatest moment, Bob Jenkins? We've got just about a minute left. Single greatest moment in the 500 storied history. So we're looking back.
Ooh, geez.
Tough call, I know.
Oh. That's easy.
Okay.
Easy. Is it
1998?
When Eddie Cheever won. No. The first race.
Yeah?
Incredible. How long did it take?
7 hours and...
6 hours. I think it was six hours and
40 minutes.
Right.
I think,
yeah, like that. Okay, now think about that. Is that not...
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Amazing.
Yeah.
They didn't have seatbelts then, by the way.
Yeah.
Or a variety of other things. And they weren't going very quick, but I can assure you that was very hard to bring those cars to the end of that race. And nobody had ever done it before. And here we are celebrating the 100th race after that.
And even 50 years ago, they had not achieved 150 miles an hour around the 2.5-mile oval, and that's pretty astounding. That
yeah, that's
we've
pretty
come
much
so
what
far
they
in 50 years.
Now, so, I'm speaking just for myself, but I presume I speak for a fair amount of our audience. I could listen to you guys all day. This has just been absolutely fascinating. I'd like to thank our guest today, as we've been talking about the 100th anniversary of the first Indianapolis 500, Bob Jenkins. It is always a pleasure to spend time with you. Thank you for being on the
program. Thank you.
Eddie Cheever, it has been a delight. Thank you for joining us today. And Mark Dill, I know you probably felt like a spear catcher there at times, but
no,
thank you. You did well. Thank you for joining us today and for taking the questions. We are going to be back next week when we devote our program to the history of the Freedom Riders with some of the people who lived it. I want to thank our listeners, and particularly the people who called, sent in questions, and spent some time with us. I'm John Kroll. Please join us next week.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Jeanette Rhodes. Board Engineer, Matt Sosi, and Intern, Monica Schwab. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.